This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross, who's off this week. Tales from the American West are marked by heroism, romance, and plenty of cruelty. But among those stories, the saga of the Donner Party stands alone. A band of pioneers sets out in covered wagons for California, and eventually, stranded, snowbound, and starving, resort to cannibalism. Our guest, Michael Wallace, says the story of the Donner Party has been sensationalized over the years, sometimes casting the settlers as inhuman ghouls. Wallace's new book chronicles the journey of the Donner Party from its beginning, illuminating the challenges the families faced and the fatal error that set them on a tragic course, accepting treacherous advice that an uncharted shortcut would ease their passage to California. Wallace concludes that in their desperation, they did what anyone would have done, and more than half the party survived. Michael Wallace has written several books about the American West. He's also a voice actor who played the sheriff in the animated films Cars 1, 2, and 3. His new book is The Best Land Under Heaven, The Donner Party in an Age of Manifest Destiny. Well, Michael Wallace, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, this is the story of people taking this journey of hundreds of miles at enormous risk. And, you know, as I thought about this, I was thinking about how modern immigrants, people who go into boats in the Mediterranean, are desperate, fleeing, you know, war and violence and poverty. A lot of these people were people of ambition and means and accomplishment. Tell us about some of these leaders of this expedition.
The three principal leaders of what came to be commonly called the Donner-Reed Party were the two Donner brothers, George and Jacob Donner, and James Reed, an Irish immigrant who struck it rich in the lead mines of Illinois. Reed became friends, at least good, strong acquaintances, of the Donner brothers. And those were the three that forged this plan to take their families, to take their livestock, to take their belongings, and to move west, to follow the California Trail to the so-called land of milk and honey. Reed was a self-made man, this Irish immigrant who came here very early to this country, ended up in Sangamon County in Springfield, an entrepreneur, built a mill, worked in early railroad development, had businesses, and ultimately ran into some business difficulties due to the Great Depression of 1837, and had to soon declare bankruptcy, and that was his reason for leaving, to start his life over again.
So we have these ambitious people moving to California, hoping to make their fortunes. You know, these were the days when the phrase manifest destiny was used to describe this impetus for settlers to move west and populate the continent. Did this matter to these people in the Donner-Reed Party, or were they just thinking about their own futures?
Oh, a little bit of both. They were obviously people of their time. Most of them were quite literate and, as you say, well off. They had to be in order to make this journey, to afford the wagons and oxen and all the rest that went with it, the herds of cattle, the servants, the hired hands. And they were certainly aware of these words, manifest destiny, that God Almighty had given the Anglo population of the eastern United States. It made it manifest that they could conquer, they could take, they could consume the rest of the continent.
So as they prepared to go hundreds of miles overland, give us a sense of how they prepared, what kinds of animals they had to acquire, what they traveled in.
They were actually quite well prepared when they embarked on this long journey across the rest of the continent. They knew that oxen, big, strong yokes of oxen, as many as 4 to 6 oxen, were necessary to pull those wagons loaded with all of their belongings that they wanted to bring with them to start these new lives. They brought with them cattle and spare horses, saddle horses. They brought essentials that they thought they would need along the way. And once they got to California, including items that they could use to trade and win the good graces of people they might encounter along the way, such as the various Indian tribes, or when they got into Mexico, which is essentially they were going, Alta California, to border out there with the Mexican natives. They brought books. They brought bottles of fine wine. And most of this material, of course, never made it to the Sierras. It eventually had to be discarded along the way.
A lot of settlers these days headed to Oregon. Everybody knew about the Oregon Trail. These folks wanted to go to California. Why?
They had swallowed the propaganda coming out of California. There were actually people in California, Anglos living in Alta California, the Mexican province, such as John Sutter, who is famous, sometimes infamous, in his own right for Sutter's Fort and a few years later the discovery of gold. He had a lot of real estate that he wanted to sell. And he and others put out the word, come to California. One of the chief promoters was a man named Lansford Hastings, a young attorney who saw an opportunity here to make some money, and he wrote an immigrant's guide to California and Oregon. And thousands of people read this book, including the Donner brothers and James Reed, and this was part of their research. And they followed Lansford Hastings' text religiously and actually to a fault. But they didn't obviously know that at the time. By the time they figured it out, it was too late.
Lansford Hastings and his advice becomes a critical part of this whole story. And there was an established route to get to California, but he had this shortcut that he wanted people to take, the Hastings cutoff. And the party had to figure out whether they wanted to take this allegedly shorter and easier route or the more established one. And at one point, they go to a trading post, Fort Bernard, and there's a mountain man there named James Clyburn who gives them some advice. Tell us about that.
James Clyburn gave them some great sage wisdom and advice. James Clyburn was indeed a authentic mountain man and knew the ways of the woods like no other. He had served in the Black Hawk War back east with Abraham Lincoln and James Reed, knew them well. But years before that, when he was a youth, he had already traveled throughout the Rocky Mountains as a trapper and trader, and he was out there again. And when he came back to make a visit to Illinois, that's where he encountered the Donner Reed party and sat down over beverages that evening around a fire with members of the Donner Reed party and focused on James Reed and said, don't take this shortcut. Lansford Hastings doesn't know what he's talking about. He, in fact, has never taken this cutoff himself. And I advise you strongly, don't take it. Stick to the known California trail. Don't take this shortcut that's going to save you time, because it won't. And unfortunately, James Reed didn't heed his old friend's advice.
So the interesting thing about this, as the Donner Reed party is making its way, and they have this guidebook from Hastings who encouraged them to take this risky, as it turned out, shortcut, Hastings himself was out in the region assisting some parties. And
yes,
they would at times come across notes, like a note on a sagebrook from Hastings. This is amazing.
It is. There were always of communicating on the trail, and this was literally the post office for them to leave these notes. But Hastings' advice was so terrible. And the irony is that his description of the Hastings cutoff in that guidebook is only a short paragraph. But, oh my goodness, that paragraph put everyone in deep peril.
I'd like for you to read from a part of the book where you're describing part of the effort that the Donner party is making to get through this cutoff that Hastings had recommended. Well, why don't you just set this up and read this for us?
Well, they had been out on the trail a good long time, and now they were out in what eventually became the state of Utah, and facing not only these incredible impenetrable thickets, but eventually salt desert. It was just one of the most difficult parts of the journey. And so Reed is out and some of his companions hunting around for Mr. Hastings, and they eventually found him, and he's giving them further advice and so forth. And so when he got back to his party, they decided to take the route that he suggested. And that's what this particular paragraph talks about. 5 miles did not seem like much, but the company learned quickly enough that for the next 2 weeks, any progress at all would be hard to come by. Some days the wagons sat still while the men hacked their way through aspen groves and ravines covered with dense brush. Large trees had to be felled and dragged off, and boulders rolled aside. At times the loads of debris were so great that it required double and triple yoked oxen teams to get the loads up the steep rises. Women and children stayed in the wagons. They prepared meals for the ravenous work parties that helped Tamsin Donner and Peggy Breen care for Luke Holleran and little Eddie Breen. The long, hard days took a toll on the immigrants and the animals.
And, of course, the awful thing is that when they hacked their way through this area, they found it led nowhere, right, to a canyon.
Yes, it was the worst possible scenario. All of that time, all of that expended energy, blood, sweat, and tears, was for naught. And we're talking about almost 3 weeks. And as I also say in that chapter, concluding, sadly, the worst was yet to come.
So the Donner Party is making its way, in terrible shape.
Terrible shape.
Short of food. And two members of their party have made their way to California. And they would eventually hear from them again. One was James Reed, who was banished after killing another member of the party. The other, these two guys, Staunton and McCutcheon, who had gone to this fellow Sutter to get supplies. But I want you to just tell us what the circumstance the remainder of the party faced when they kind of came up to this one spot where they ended up camping at Truckee Lake. What was their circumstance, and what was the challenge they faced finishing the journey?
By October, it became evident that winter was setting in much earlier than expected, and in fact it did. And that, of course, was another big problem, another big reason for this tragedy. They made it up to what's called Truckee Meadows, right around where Reno now is, and were looking towards the Sierras and scaling that peak and going through what was then called Fremont Pass down the western slope. They got to these meadows and they decided to, oh my God, we made it this far, let's rest. So they rested, and rested a bit too long. And they ended up literally stopped by these winter storms. They could go no farther. So they set up two camps, the so-called Lake Camp near the banks of Truckee Lake, now Donner Lake, and one down camps with the Donner parties down on Alder Creek. And there they stayed from October throughout the winter of 1846-1847, just trying to survive.
There was one point where early in the game, they made it almost over the pass, right? What happened?
There were a few times when they didn't just get into these camps and give up and sit down. There were forays out, one in particular, which ended up ultimately being successful. But there were different tries, and they'd get up as far as they could go, and then they'd be repelled by this incredibly deep snow. We're talking about snow 20 and 25 feet deep and just impossible to get through. They would even make fashion snowshoes, and they tried all kinds of ways to get through the snow and couldn't. And at the same time, Reed and others who had made it in were trying to get back to them, and they, in fact, were repelled coming up the western side. So there was kind of this impasse there. One party was formed that eventually became known as the Forlorn Hope, a large group of men, women, and young lads, and they struck out. And that's the party that eventually the survivors from that party did make it in to Johnson's ranch and on to Sutter's place.
They were the ones who had fashioned snowshoes, right?
Some of those had fashioned snowshoes. Others had tried the snowshoes and failed, but they had snowshoes, and that helped them a great deal. But it was at a great cost. In fact, it was this group that we now call the Forlorn Hope. That's the group where we find the first evidence of cannibalism occurring.
Yeah, so let's just stop there. What happens? How do they end up eating human flesh?
People are very squeamish about this whole idea of cannibalism, and I can't tell you how many times people have said, you're writing a book about the Donner Party. Weren't those the pioneers who got stuck in the snow and ate each other? And the short answer is yes. And that's important because if that hadn't happened, they would be a footnote. They would have slipped over the Sierras. But it did, in fact, happen. There's much, much more to the story than the cannibalism, but the cannibalism definitely did occur. We have written accounts of it from the survivors themselves. So it in the camps and on the Forlorn Hope Party, both, they ate literally everything before they had to turn to human flesh. They, of course, killed the great oxen, the horses, everything, and ate that meat. They boiled the hides. They picked out the bone marrow. They made this gelatinous, awful goo from the hides, and it had very little, if any, nutritional value. They ate field mice they caught in their cabins and camps. They finally got to the point where they had to kill all their beloved dogs, very sadly, and eat all of them. And then they were chewing on pine cones and on ponderosa pine bark. They're starving and they're freezing to death. They're becoming delirious. They had to chew on something. And so they chewed on anything they could find. But ultimately, they turned to the protein that was the human, the dead companions, friends, family, that they had storehouse that had already died from starvation and from hypothermia in the snowbanks. And they did that totally to survive, but it was very much the last resort. And it was the last resort for the Forlorn Hope Party as well. They were beginning to die. And so they also turned to human flesh.
You write of a moment the first time, I don't know where the description comes from, but the first time one of that party, where they sat down and started to eat the roasted remains of one of the party. And
yes, it was a young woman, and as she was sitting there already weeping, eating this flesh, she saw across the fire others eating, and she realized that they were eating some of the remains of her own dear younger brother, and she became quite hysterical. They tried their best not to consume flesh of family members. They were so careful. They cut small pieces of flesh and dried it or roasted it, so it didn't even look like human flesh. And that's what they did. And so when people say to me, oh, how can this cannibalism, how awful, I always just turn it right around on them and say, what would you do? What would you do if you were starving to death, freezing to death, and your children were around you and you saw them and they were dying and you knew that this store of protein was there? What would you do? I know what I would do. I would brandish my knife.
In the end, how many people survived? How many died?
Well, it ended up this way. 41 people died. Now, this is talking about once they were into the camps, and 46 survived. Several of them perished before they even reached the Sierra Nevadas, and as we said, one died just after reaching the valley. But the rest of them, of course, were physically and psychologically scarred, and some of them for life. But I think it's very important to say, though, that out of all those parties that did make it survive, two entire families survived, two large families, the Reed family and the Breen family, this Irish family from Iowa. They all survived. But it was just the Reed family alone that did never partook of a piece of human flesh. They somehow were able to avoid that due to the diligence and the care of the mother, Margaret Reed.
She managed to squirrel away a little bit of food here and there and ration it.
She did.
Do you think this story tells us something about the American character or the American West?
Well, I think it does. I think it tells us not only about the American West, but really about the whole nation. I think that's why a lot of people who are reading the book are finding that there's great relevance for this book, for this story today, because so many people find that really the idea of manifest destiny still exists in this country, this whole idea of American exceptionalism. And I find that, too. I find that we, the editorial we, are so guilty of committing that common mistake, and that's produced this great cliche that is so true. Those of us who do not learn our history are doomed to repeat it, the sins of the past. And that is certainly the case with the Donner Party. And the words that just ring out to me continually are two words that combined can be very fatal, then as now. And those words are ignorance and arrogance. Very potent, very deadly.
Michael Wallace, thanks so much for sharing it with us.
It's been my pleasure.
Michael Wallace's book is The Best Land Under Heaven, The Donner Party in an Age of Manifest Destiny. The South Korean filmmaker Bong Joon-ho is known for his dark, imaginative, and often satirical thrillers, such as The Host, Memories of Murder, and Snowpiercer, which starred Chris Evans and Tilda Swinton. Bong and Swinton have teamed up again on Okja, a new film produced and distributed by Netflix. Film critic Justin Chang has this review.
The wildly inventive sci-fi thriller Okja tells the story of a courageous 13-year-old Korean girl named Mija, played by An Seo-hyun, who is determined to protect her closest companion from being chewed up and spat out by the forces of 21st-century capitalism. That companion is Okja, an enormous, genetically modified pig, a super pig, as she's been branded by the executives at Mirando, a multinational agrochemical corporation that is trying to spearhead a revolution in global food production. In the movie's prologue, we see CEO Lucy Mirando, played by Tilda Swinton, raving to the press about her plan to ship 26 miracle piglets to 26 farms around the world and hold an international contest to see which pig turns out to be the biggest specimen. 10 years later, the clear winner of the contest is Okja, who has swollen to Clifford the Big Red Dog proportions, looks like a mutant hippopotamus, and enjoys an idyllic life on a remote Korean mountainside with Mija, her devoted caretaker. And when Mirando employees come to reclaim Okja and bring her to the company's New York headquarters for inspection, breeding, and eventual slaughter, Mija is determined to save Okja at any cost. Okja is the latest feature written and directed by the South Korean filmmaker Bong Joon-ho, and a companion piece of sorts to his 2006 monster movie, The Host. In that film, the disposal of toxic waste in the Han River leads to the rise of a hideous creature that wreaks havoc on Seoul and abducts a young girl. Okja similarly mixes genre thrills and environmentally conscious satire, and it builds to a discreet but disturbing slaughterhouse climax that could put you off bacon for a lifetime. But it's a gentler movie in many ways, not least because the beast here is entirely benign. Indeed, Mija and Okja share the only pure, unconditional relationship in a movie where everyone else is compromised by some political or business agenda. As Mija follows Okja from Seoul to New York, she is both helped and hindered by a group of nonviolent eco-activists called the Animal Liberation Front, who want to use Okja to take the Mirando Corporation down from the inside. The movie is clear-eyed enough to acknowledge when their actions are misguided, even in service of a righteous cause. Similarly, Bong reserves a measure of compassion for Lucy Mirando. Swinton plays her with wide-eyed, monomaniacal intensity, but she also shows us Lucy's profound insecurity, which only deepens as the fight to free Okja generates unflattering headlines and forces the company to go into damage control mode.
The synthesis of old Mirando and new Mirando was impeccable. I took nature and science, and I synthesized, and everyone loved it. You remember what the New York Times said about us super pigs? Lucy Mirando is pulling off the impossible. She is making us fall in love with a creature that we are already looking forward to eating. I mean, these are journalists who never write about pigs. They never write about pigs. They wrote about our pigs. 10 years in planning. On the cusp of a product launch that will feed millions. And what happens? We get tangled up in this terrorism thing, and somehow we end up being the ones who look bad.
Swinton gave a similarly eccentric performance in Bong's 2014 post-apocalyptic thriller Snowpiercer, his first film shot primarily in English with Hollywood stars. Few Asian filmmakers have managed to achieve that level of crossover success. But Bong's command of genre is so fluent, his action thriller style so fleet and accessible, that the usual barriers of language and culture effectively collapse. Okja, a critique of globalization that is also a product of a globalized film industry, continues this progression toward the mainstream. The movie is such an ambitious conceptual juggling act that it's no surprise that Bong can't fully sustain it over his 2-hour running time. Some of the satire in the second half is too broad and overstated, and not all the disparate acting styles cohere. Giancarlo Esposito makes a droll impression as Lucy Mirando's calculating number 2, and Paul Dano is charming as the intensely scrupulous Animal Liberation Front leader. But Jake Gyllenhaal goes gratingly over the top as Dr. Johnny, a Steve Irwin-style TV personality who represents Mirando to the world. In the end, though, there are only 2 performances that really matter. An makes you root for Mija at every step of her journey, and Okja immediately takes her place among the most touching and realistic computer-generated characters ever made. Andy Serkis couldn't have played her any better. Okja begins streaming on Netflix this Wednesday, and will also be playing a limited theatrical run in Los Angeles and New York. If the latter option is available to you, seize it. This super pig is worth seeing on the biggest screen you can find.
Justin Chang is a film critic for the Los Angeles Times. Coming up, journalist Suad McKennett tells us about meeting with commanders of ISIS and the Taliban. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. When my next guest, journalist Suad McKennett, chooses to go and conduct an interview, it can be a life or death decision. She spent much of the past 15 years reporting on Islamic extremist groups, and she's interviewed leaders of Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, and ISIS, some of the world's most wanted men. McKennett grew up as a Muslim in Germany, and she's interested in understanding what jihadists think and how they appeal to disaffected young Muslims around the world. Besides speaking to members of radical organizations, she's interviewed many of their recruits in the Middle East and Europe. McKennett has reported on terrorism for the New York Times and is now a national security correspondent for the Washington Post. Through her reporting, she uncovered the identity of Jihadi John, the masked ISIS fighter featured in several beheading videos. Suad McKennitt has written three previous books. Her latest is I Was Told to Come Alone, My Journey Behind the Lines of Jihad. Well, Suad McKennitt, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, in this book, you describe a meeting with an ISIS leader known as Abu Yusuf. Who was he? What was his role in ISIS?
So Abu Yusuf is still alive, and that's why I could not reveal his true identity. He is a younger man, actually, now in his, I would say, early 30s, who grew up in Europe. His background is also he's of North African descent. He spoke a couple of languages fluently, and he is within ISIS somebody who is now one of the responsible figures for ISIS external operations. So he is pretty high level. And when I requested a meeting with somebody from the ISIS leadership, I had no idea who they would send. But I was absolutely surprised when I spoke to him, first of all, about how much knowledge he had, also about what was going on in the world. But I felt very sorry that we lost somebody into the hands of this ideology, somebody who could have had a different life.
I want you to talk a bit about arranging this meeting. Now, when you did this, you knew this was a group that had taken and executed journalists. You had to be concerned for your safety. How did you manage that?
So I have to say the executions didn't happen then. It was a couple of weeks before the execution took place. But of course, I knew that they had kidnapped journalists. This was new terrain for me as well. I had covered the so-called world of jihad since 9/11, and I had encounters with people from various groups, Al-Qaeda, as well as the Taliban and other undergroups. But I had no idea what kind of group I had to deal with here. I was a little nervous because the guarantees they gave me for my safety were not as, how can I say this?
Ironclad.
as the ones that I got for previous meetings with other group members. And it was a risk. I knew I was taking a big risk. I knew they had kidnapped journalists. And in fact, actually, the person who did help arranging this interview told me as well, look, with those guys, if he feels that you are, for example, a spy, or if you ask him a question that he does not like or that makes him suspicious, you may, you know, be in huge danger. And I took the decision to still go ahead with it because I felt we knew not enough about this group. And there were so many different ideas. I had attended a couple of meetings with very knowledgeable people who were advising also the former president and who had some strange ideas about what ISIS is and what the caliphate would be. And then I said, it's my duty actually also to take this risk and to tell people who they are, what they think. And that's why I decided to do it.
So there are these arrangements. You gave your colleagues phone numbers to call in case you disappeared, not people in ISIS, but others who might help. They're switching cars, you know, picking batteries out of cell phones. You finally end up in this white Honda in the passenger seat, and there he is in the backseat. As you say, a very sophisticated guy. And I love that you were able to determine, when you spoke to him in a North African Arabic accent, to determine where he came from. This was part interview, it seems, and part debate about
it was
the big. Just give us a sense of the conversation, what you asked, what he said.
So I started first with general questions because I had to test the waters, right? I had no idea. I mean, again, I had in mind what the person who arranged the interview had told me, that he said, look, those guys, they're no joke. If they feel suspicious or if you ask them a wrong question, it could end up very, very badly. And I did see that he had some kind of gun in his pocket. So I felt, you know, very nervous and first had to ask some general questions about what the caliphate is, what the idea of the caliphate was, in order to see how he would answer. And then at some stage he spoke about jihad and he spoke about the legitimacy of what they were doing. And I began to to counter that and to tell him, I mean, when I figured out that he was of a similar descent, I started also telling him, look, what you describe as jihad is not what, for example, my grandfather had described as jihad, and there are different, there are several rules, and you're breaking all of them. And he actually accepted that, the discussion and debate, and he, but I could see the more I debated with him and I encountered what he said, the more nervous and angry he grew. And at some stage, I felt that I had to stop because he made very clear that he was no longer, he was not accepting any kind of different view. And this is, this was a message that I got very, you know, very fast. We are dealing with a group that sees any person who has a different point of view, and no matter if the person is Christian, Jewish, or Muslim, as an enemy. And that came across as very strong when I spoke to him. Yeah.
Did he say anything that you weren't expecting?
Well, I was very surprised to hear the confidence he had about how well organized and structured the caliphate was. He basically told me that the group used the turmoil of the so-called Arab Spring in order to send cells and set up different cells in different countries. He told me that there were already cells in Libya, in Tunisia, in the Gulf region, and that, and also in Egypt, and that they were in fact already plotting and planning all this since 2011. And also the arrogance, that the tone he used when he spoke about that they were absolutely certain, even if they would be attacked, which is of course happening now and for the last couple of months, that the idea and the ideology of the caliphate would live on, and that they have actually planned ahead of times for all this.
You come from an interesting background for this work. You grew up in Germany. Your mom's from Turkey. Your dad from Morocco. And your grandfather, you write, was actually in the movement for independence from France, was arrested and beaten, and his property taken. You grew up mostly in Germany. I think when you were a little kid, you spent some time in Morocco with your grandma.
Yes.
But growing up in Germany, in a Muslim family, how much discrimination or acceptance did you feel?
When I was in my teenage years, I felt a lot of, you could say, anger or discrimination, because my father worked as a chef, and we lived in a very nice neighborhood in Frankfurt, and we were to a certain, we were actually the only family of a Muslim guest workers. This is how they used to call people like my parents, guest worker descent, and some of the kids in the neighborhood were not allowed to play with us. This had, I guess, partially the reason was for that, because we were of, you know, guest worker background and not people who came from academia or a wealthy background, but also because we were Muslims. And even though my parents tried to really push us into the society, I went to a Christian kindergarten, to a Christian after school daycare. I had lived in Morocco with my grandmother, who had Jewish neighbors, and I played with the kids there. So we grew up in a way that we actually wanted to be part of the society, but felt that the society, or at least the part where we lived, didn't want us to be part of that circle. And it became a little difficult for me when I saw the houses of Turkish migrants burning in Germany in the 90s. And I really, and then also a situation where my brother and I were a group of skinheads in a car where after my brother and I, and I was walking with my brother, who's much younger. I was in my teenage years. And then there was this car, and a group of men started shouting, "Gypsies, we will kill you, we will gas you," and they were after us. And I told my brother to run, and he was this little boy. He was screaming, and he was not fast enough. So I basically lifted him up, and we ran. And if it weren't for another car that basically made some noise as well and told those guys to stop, I don't know what would have happened. And this was a very scary moment for both of us. And it was a moment where I went back home to my parents and said, pack your stuff, we have to leave. They don't want us here. So I do understand that those kind of situations can make people vulnerable to easy explanations. Easy explanation would have been, Germans don't want us here, we need to go, pack your stuff. But my parents, as well as my godparents who were Germans, were of course saying, this is a small group of people. If you give in, those people will win. So that's why we shouldn't do it.
You spoke with a senior Taliban leader in Karachi once, and one of these things where it was a risky thing to go to. You had to be careful, you know, get rid of your cell phone, et cetera. But you have a conversation with him. And at one point he says, you know, okay, stop writing. Let's talk about life. Now, you know, Sister Suad, I'm looking for a second wife. And he was talking about you. And it sounded like he meant it. Is this a common experience?
Well, I was trying to avoid first to basically accept that he was talking about me. I was able to talk him out of this idea, right? I told him, isn't one wife headache enough? And then we, you know, he was laughing. It happened quite a lot of time, quite often that some of those guys would ask me to get married to them. And I then just, you know, say that my parents have a word to say in the decision, you know, what kind of husband I would choose, which of course they know is not true, but they also understand that it means no. And it's just really, really interesting because I ask them all these tough questions. I don't go easy on them, and they still have this idea of asking to get married. And in the case of the Taliban commander, this whole it was a very interesting situation because his wife got pregnant with twin daughters and he named one of them after me. But then one day I get this phone call and he's basically saying, he's asking me, listen, I want to ask you, when you were a baby, were you a nice child? And I said, well, I don't know. I guess so, yes. And he said, well, I don't think so. And I said, why? And he told me, well, this one child, she's an angel, the one we gave a different name. She's an angel. She sleeps, she listens, she eats, she's silent. But the one we named after you, she's just a devil. She screams the whole time. She is she has her own head. And I said, well, I didn't tell you to name her after me, right? That's what you get. So and this is just a very surreal situation. But I also confronted him with how they treat women. I confronted him with the question why they were thrown acid into the faces of women and why they would dare to tell women not to go to school, and what this had to do with Islam. And he was willing to take on the questions. I mean, he didn't necessarily give me logical answers, but he listened and gave me his answers.
And the answers were, this is what the Prophet would want, and or what?
Well, no, actually, he knew that I would all that we were at, we reached the point, you know, when we had this dinner, this barbecue meeting, where he knew he cannot come with this easy answer. This is what the Prophet want, because I would have told him, well, all the wives of the Prophet were strong women, and the first wife was in fact a businesswoman. So he told me that he showed me his hand, and he said, look, are all the fingers on this hand the same? And I said, no. And he said, and this is how it is with our group. He told me that he actually liked smart women, and that his wife had studied as well, and that he wanted his daughters to study. And he told me that there are people within the group who indeed would not want to see their daughter study and who would do this kind of horrible things to women, but that he was different. So that's what he said. I met his wife once, and he was right. She did study. I spoke to her, and but it's not like she's doing work now, but she did study. He was telling the truth.
You know, we do have a president here who has advocated a travel ban on some Muslim countries. It's under dispute in the courts. He also said during the campaign, in talking about ISIS, we're going to have to be so vicious. He talked about bringing back torture, referred to killing the families of terrorist leaders. And I'm wondering how you think this is playing, both among ISIS leaders and among those who might be susceptible to their appeals.
Well, I think that I'm looking at those statements from different perspectives. Well, as a matter of fact, I know from people within ISIS that they have been cutting and pasting some of the statements President Trump made during the campaign and are using those in order to show Muslims in the West, look, this is how Western leaders are thinking about your religion and about you, and you will never be part of the society. So they are using some of those statements for their recruitment, which is, of course, very dangerous. So it does play into the hands of ISIS and Al-Qaeda, definitely.
Well, Suad McKennitt, thank you for your reporting. Hope you can stay safe. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Suad McKennitt is a national security correspondent for The Washington Post. Her new book is I Was Told to Come Alone, My Journey Behind the Lines of Jihad. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Heidi Simon. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Teresa Madden, Mooj Zaidi, and Thea Challoner. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.